everybody, because I know many of you can't see everybody on your screen. So we'll say hello first to Jinru, and to Michael, and to Bob O, Shoketsu, Sydney, Sam, Mary, Jenny, Jim, Bob K, Mark W, John, Marv, Bruce, Pat, Joan, Anne, Jessica, Cody, Amelia,
morning,
Marcia, Cinda, and Ruth Ann. All right. Let's see. Right. Announcements next Sunday. If you want to attend, participate in our Sagaki ceremony, that will start at 9:30. So that's in place of the chanting service as opposed to the Dharma talk. So there'll be a Dharma talk as usual. The chant, so the at 9:30 then, we will probably, what we'll do, we'll probably share, we'll give you a link to the Sagaki chant if you want to pull it up on your own. There's like, this is stuff I need to take care of. We'll probably also link to it so that, you know, you can just kind of view it on your screen as we go. And kind of we'll scroll through it as we go. It's a very interesting chanting service that involves some singing, some Gregorian chant kind of singing, where my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, was a Church of England organist, and she took Buddhist chants and put them to music. So simple kind of, it's not Gregorian chant per se, but it's the same kind of very simple pattern. And then some Dharanis, and the idea is that during this ceremony, we are kind of opening the gate to the hungry ghost realm. So in Buddhist cosmology, there's six different realms. You don't have to believe any of this. Some Buddhists in the world do, but we don't have to believe any of it literally. But we're opening the door to the hungry ghost realm and inviting hungry ghosts to be with us for a little while. So we always thought of this, we had a retreat around it, which perhaps we'll do someday, where essentially we're inviting unresolved karma. So hungry ghosts, for one reason or another, they were stingy in their past life, and in this life they're wandering around unable to find nourishment. So they look for love in all the wrong places, I like to say, and what they really need is the truth, but they can't accept it. So we give them whatever they can accept. So we make an altar. So if any of you have an altar with a little Buddha image or Bodhisattva image and flowers and a candle and the typical setup, traditionally what we do with the Sagaki altar is cover the Buddha image with a nice cloth, because the hungry ghosts will be scared away by a Buddha image. And then we put out some treats, some candy, some chips, whatever, to entice the hungry ghosts. And the idea is that, according to the mythology, they never find sustenance. They never find anything that they can eat, except when it is an offering of the faithful. So this is an example of when we make this sincere offering, this is like the one time of the year that the hungry ghost can eat something. So typically there's donuts involved. I will dress up my altar as the Sagaki altar, but we're also encouraging folks, if you want to do this at home, to similarly cover your Buddha image and put out some treats for your hungry ghosts. And also, if anyone Is anyone you want to remember who has died within the last year or who has never been remembered at the Sagaki ceremony? This is kind of like most cultures just have a kind of end of the season, catch all Saints Day, remember the dead things. So it's all kind of clued together. This is also a moment to remember the dead. So we will read the names of the people that you send in to the Bright Ways End email address while we are chanting. And let's see, Jinryu just sent him. What would you want to explain what you mean, Jinryu?
You're taking up my time.
You have until 12:15. Let's see. I think that's it for announcements. Anyone else? Okay. So if you do have those names that you want remembered at Sagaki, just send them to info@brightwaysend.org. So today we have a way-seeking mind talk by Jinryu. So I will turn it over to her.
I do have a cat in front of me. He's driving me crazy. So be aware of that, please. And no, I cannot shut the door on her. That would be worse. And I want to thank everybody for being here. And I first have my usual disclaimer, which is it's very hard for me to talk about my spiritual journey without revealing some aspects of my past that are private. And so I hope you can respect that and leave those things here and not take them outside of this little session. And secondly, I want to say that by way of an introduction, on Tuesday night, we used to go through a whole list of things that we would read. This week it would be Fuken Zazengi, and next week it would be Genjo Kōan, and the week after that it'd be something different. So I think I may have heard between now, when we do it every Tuesday night, and the 4 or 5 years before that, I think I may have heard the Fuken Zazengi maybe 50, 60 times. And on Tuesday night of this week, I heard for the first time, for you must know the true Dharma appears of itself. I had never heard that before. And so, if ever there were a theme to my talk, that would be it, that the Dharma is really everywhere. And at least for me, it appears when I'm ready to hear it. And it really is a part of my life. You can make it a part of your life. It takes a little bit of work, but that's my story. I want to read just a few things that will explain the life I came from, and it's just a few words and phrases, starting with when I was a kid. Methodist, alcoholic dad, youngest, two older brothers, toxic masculinity, abusive, lacking in intimacy, never felt entirely comfortable, felt like I was on my own, and I had to find a way to support myself and to help all of you. At the age of 16, I discovered alcohol, and I knew within about 4 or 5 months that I was addicted and it would be very hard to stop. And by the age of 25, this is how I would describe myself: angry, dishonest, deeply depressed, suicidal, selfish, self-centered, paranoid, mean, antisocial, driven by fear, and I complained about everything. And I quit drinking every single morning, and I lasted about 6 hours, maybe. And then a Dharma gate opened, and I was very surprised 40 years later to read something in the Bendoa, of all things, that described what happened to me perfectly. And it goes like this. Now, the realm of all Buddhas is inconceivable. It cannot be reached by consciousness. Much less can those who have no trust, who lack wisdom, know it. Only those who have right trust and great capacity can enter this realm. And that's what happened when I went to my first 12-step meeting. The people there said to me, we can take one look at you and know that you're suffering because we suffer from the same thing you do. But if you will just follow what we do, your life is going to be totally amazing beyond your wildest imagination. Just like Dogen said, the realm of all Buddhas is inconceivable. And they said, you know, it's not rational. You can't think your way through this. In fact, you can think about it too much and think your way out of here. And Dogen said, it cannot be reached by consciousness. And they said, you know, we did this, and so we know you can too. And we ask you to trust what we're telling you, do the things we suggest that you do, and it could be really, really hard, but we can help you. And Dogen said, only those who have right trust and great capacity can enter this realm. And I was desperate. And so I decided to do what they suggested. And lo and behold, 7 days later, I woke up on a Saturday morning and I realized that I had gone 7 whole days without a drink. And I can tell you to my dying day, I do not know how that happened. At the time, I called it God. At that time, my God looked a lot like Michelangelo's Moses, if you know what that looks like. It's a gigantic gray marble statue. It was a spiritual awakening for me, for sure. And it opened a Dharma gate of the 12 steps, which really is a lifetime of self-discovery. You really do spend a lot of time over and over studying yourself. And over the years after that, I tried to get my hands on everything I could from an educational perspective about the 12 steps, about spiritual life, about God, about religion, about anything that I thought would help me. And I just came to the realization that my Judeo-Christian background, this patriarchal religion that I had been following, was not really working. And then another Dharma gate opened about 20 years ago. And I began to study yoga. And I studied yoga many times a week and ultimately got into a yoga teacher training program. And as it turns out, I decided I didn't want to be a yoga teacher, but it did introduce me to meditation. And I began to meditate instead of pray. And I do remember long meditations at that time where once or twice for a few moments, I had this very deep feeling of peace. The Christians would call it the peace that passeth understanding. And it was beyond my understanding. But all I can say is, I felt loved. And I felt very peaceful. It was really sweet. And the 12 steps will encourage you, they really kind of beat you over the head about it, to stay in the present moment. In fact, I just heard this the other day. You got to stay in the present moment. But one thing I've always felt is that they're not very good at telling you how to do that. And I'm not even sure that they do that well. But something happened as I was studying yoga and hearing Buddhist quotes and commentary. Maybe Buddhism could teach me how to do that. So we moved out here in 2007, and I began to look for places to practice Buddhism, and they were always on the east side of town. And for me, the river is a psychological barrier. But finally, one day, I was driving down Barnes Road, and I saw this big orange sign on a little old building, and it said Brightway Zen. And I retired on April the 4th, 2014, and the following Tuesday, I went to Brightway Zen. So I have deep respect for people who are working, for people with little kids. I could not have done that the way I was working. But I finally got here. And I became a member maybe 3 or 4 months after I got here. And then the following spring, I studied the precepts and took Jukai. And I got my Wagesa, and I needed that Wagesa. I needed some kind of outward sign that I was a bona fide practicing Buddhist, because I didn't want to say that to people and have them talk about, you know, wearing their headphones and listening to music and zoning out and, you know, well, meditation is great. I wanted them to know I was talking about the real thing. I was very fortunate that the first thing we studied when I was there was Domyo's book, The Idiot's Guide to Zen Living. And to this day, I think it's the best introduction to Zen I've ever read. And I ate up every single word. And the only thing I didn't fully understand was no self. But I kind of think that you guys didn't understand it either. So I didn't worry about it. And I just let it go by. But I took what was really important to me. And that was what was important. And I encourage others to do that. Don't overthink it. It'll come to you when it's supposed to. It took me a year after I got my Wagesa to ask Domyo 3 times to be my teacher, because you have to ask her 3 times. And I did, and finally she said yes. And then it took me 2 years before I finished my Rakusu, which I'm wearing now. I went this morning and looked for my first one that I made, which was perfect, and she approved of it, except it was an inch too small all the way around, and it looked like a potholder. And she said, look, I can approve this. It really looks good, but for the rest of your life, people are going to be asking you why your Rakusu is so small. So that was right before a Rohatsu, maybe my first one. And during Rohatsu, I decided I needed to try and make another one. So this is my second one. I actually made 3 altogether. So if anybody, I have a half-made Rakusu, just in case anybody wants it. I was also very fortunate that the next book we read, and see, on Tuesday nights, what we're doing now is what we used to do all the time. We would get a book, we would study it, listen to Domio, discuss it. And for me, it was just an absolutely wonderful way of learning. And the next book we studied was Realizing the Genjo Koan by Shohaku Okamura. And I'm going to reference a couple of books, so I put them in the chat. I did not mention that one. But if it weren't for the way we studied that Genjo Koan, I don't think I would love it the way I love it today. There's a passage in there which those of you who know it are very familiar with. Firewood becomes ash. Ash cannot become firewood again, or words to that effect. And I noticed that every time we read that, I would get choked up on that line. And finally, one day I decided to have an interview with Domio and talk about it. And I don't remember exactly what Domio said. All I know is that it was very peaceful. It just made me feel so comfortable. It made me calm down about death. And I began to look upon death. You know, mind you, I've been practicing Buddhist now for, gosh, a year maybe. And I began to look upon death as a process. You know, in the 90s in corporate America, we studied process management a lot because if you had the absolute best process, you would give great customer service. And there was a process and a process owner. And I began to look upon life as a process of which death was simply another phase of it. And the only thing I knew was that I was not the process owner, and I still have to remember that. And Domio said, if you want me to be your teacher, you have to go to a retreat at least once. So the first retreat I went to was the Silver Dragon Retreat at Great Bell Zen Monastery. And it was for 4 days, and I figured if I could do that, maybe I could do a long one. So 2 months later, I went to the retreat on Samish Island, where the guiding teacher is Norman Fisher. And it was a beautiful retreat. I just remember, I don't know the name of this, but it's at the end where everybody lines up and asks the teacher a question, and you're asking your question in front of a bunch of people. And I didn't know what I was going to say. I was just going to bow and say thank you. But all of a sudden, the thing that popped into my head was deeply moving. And I said, you know, all my life, I have tried to forgive people in my past. There are people in my past who really hurt me. And I just can't seem to do it. I just can't seem to forgive them. Tell me what I should do. And the first thing he said was, first of all, you have to forgive yourself, which, you know, any therapist will tell you that. And I mean, come on. But it was spur of the moment. But the next thing he said was life-changing. And he said, who says you have to forgive them anyway? And, this is like 18 months into my practice, and my life changed dramatically with that response. And now I realize that I can be kind, and I can be loving, and I can remember good times. And forgiveness doesn't even matter. And maybe that is forgiveness. I don't know. But hearing someone say you don't have to was very freeing and very life-changing. Then I went to Rohatsu. First of all, I talked to Domio about that retreat afterward because I had not obeyed silence very well, and I was embarrassed about that. And she really impressed upon me the importance of silence in a retreat. And I came to realize on my own that if I want my mind to be quiet, I have to be quiet. And that when you're quiet, that's when the really good stuff happens. And I went to my first Rohatsu, and that's when I understood the importance of Sangha. I don't have a very good sense of direction. I get very disoriented in a large room with all these 30 black seats lined up here and 30 black seats lined up on the other side. But when I saw the woman who was sitting to my left, I always knew where my seat was. Somebody on my left, somebody on my right, assigned seats. And at the end of that session, I tried to thank both of them, but the guy left pretty early. But I did thank the woman sitting on my left and told her how much I appreciated her presence. And I really did. And she was sitting in a chair. And so every time I had to get up off the cushion and sit in a chair, I just felt good about that. And I figured if she was sitting there a long time, and I felt like if she could do it, I could do it. And it was just so supportive. And that is what my Sangha has come to mean to me. And so if you were to ask me today what I believe in, I would tell you that I believe in a practice that will help me get through whatever I have to in life. And if ever there has been an experience of up and down and up and down again, it has been this year. And I have personal experience that my practice has sustained me. I mean, very moment by moment has sustained me. My practice today consists of sitting almost every day, and I say almost only to give myself the opportunity not to be 100% perfect. I have a reliance on the four Bodhisattva vows. I used to attend Saturday, every Saturday, and during the Saturday practice, we recite the four Bodhisattva vows. And, you know, it wouldn't be a full room. It was maybe four or five or six or eight of us. But reciting those vows together, it was very hard not for me to take that seriously. So I do take them seriously. I practice metta every single day. And I rely heavily on the precepts. I try to make them a part of my life. And as I said, I listed in the chat some of the books I'm going to reference, but my favorite book on the precepts is Mind of Clover. I don't know if that helps any. Mind of Clover by Robert Aiken. And Robert Aiken is from my father's generation, or he was. He died a while back, and they were both in the Pacific during World War II. And so I sometimes feel like when I hear him, it's not unlike listening to my dad. What I would encourage people to do, and first of all, that's my recommendation on the book. I know that there are at least half the people on this call who would disagree with that. But what I do encourage people to do, if you've taken Jukai, is to take a precept next spring and present it. Because until you study it and really try and take it in and figure out how it's going to work in your life, that's when you really know it. Last year in the spring, I presented the fifth precept, which is, I still have to read it. Do not dwell on past mistake, create wisdom from ignorance. And I can tell you, and I'm very sincere when I say this, that just the other day on Friday, I encountered a situation that required me to look at it through the lens of the fifth precept. And by doing so, I was able to develop compassion for that situation and those people. Another book, which I just totally adore, and I'll show it to you because it's bright yellow. You can't miss it. It's called Why Buddhism is True by Robert Wright. And I read it for the second time this fall, and I'll probably read it again next year for the third time. Domio has referenced it a couple of times, but it's all about how we think we're in control, but it really is our thoughts that are in control. And the problem with our thoughts is that they are not true, for the most part. And I recently put in my email signature a quote from Brad Warner, and I cleaned it up for my email signature, so I'll say it raw this time. But Brad Warner is a Zen teacher and a punk rocker, and this is what he says. Real wisdom is the ability to understand the incredible extent to which you bullshit yourself every single moment of every day. And I just take that in and believe it with my heart and soul, if I could only remember to believe it every single moment. But these are some of the thoughts that I have, and I bet other people have them too. One of them is, I know what you think. You think, fill in the blank. And that's impossible. I don't know what you think. Nobody can know what each of us thinks. Another one that is very common for me and is very subtle, I don't necessarily hear it. I know everything. And then my favorite one, which I believe to be universal, is I am right. And I won't ask for a show of hands. About 3 or 4 months ago, I sent around, it was in response to some conversation we were having about the election and the news and fake news, and I sent around a link to an interview with a guy by the name of Sinan Aral, who wrote a book called The Hype Machine. And he's an expert on social media and fake news. And quoting from this interview, he said something like, you know, you really do have to pause and check your emotions and reflect on what you're reading or listening to. And if it's disgusting, salacious, anger-inducing, that could be a sign that it's fake. And so, I have a thought that says, Jin Ryu, these people are bored. They can't wait until you finish. They think you're a fake. When you get off this call for the rest of the afternoon, they're going to talk about you and laugh behind your back. And I just don't think I'm alone in having thoughts like that. I really don't. Mara is the Hindu and Buddhist deity who, when the Buddha was on the verge of becoming enlightened, sent all kinds of distractions to keep him from seeing the truth. And she sent, I call her a she, the Hindus I think identify him as a man. She sent beautiful dancing girls. She sent ferocious animals. She sent armies. And he just kept right on sitting and seeking the truth. And I can still hear Chosen Bays at Great Bow saying, Mara, is that you? Yes. I remember very clearly Chosen was speaking about the Platform Sutra. And I was so impressed with it, I went out and got the book Platform Sutra by Red Pine. I also didn't list that one, but it doesn't matter because that was 4 or 5 years ago and I still haven't read it, but I have it. But she spoke from that and said, you know, the beings that we vow to free in the four Bodhisattva vows, they're not out there. They're in here. And I was blown away by that thought because you have no idea how many times I thought to myself, how can I help you people? How can I bring you to the truth and still be a good Bodhisattva? And I don't have to. And I think you should be very happy about that. The beings I have to free are up here. The delusions that are inexhaustible, and believe me, for me, they are exhausting, are up here, and I vow to end them. I am the source of my own suffering. Big realization. Another part of my practice that was an absolute game changer is loving kindness. And I realize it's not for everybody. This is the book I used, Sharon Salzberg, and that's in the chat. She's kind of like the diva of loving kindness. The book is also about all the Brahma Viharas, which include compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And I haven't delved into those deeply, and someday I'm sure I will. But I practice metta every day. The book is full of exercises and they can appear very tedious. And I just picked one. And I picked one where she told me to practice metta on myself every day for 2 weeks. So I did. Jana, may you be safe. Jana, may you be content. I couldn't say happy, because who's happy really? I thought content was good enough. I was happy with content. Jana, may you be in the best of health. And there are 4 or 5 things, 3 to 5, that you can just really tweak and make them your own. But those are the things I said to myself every single morning for 2 weeks. And then one day, I walked into the New Seasons to get my groceries, and I had a big smile on my face, and I don't know why. And it was an ear-to-ear grin, and I thought there was a party going on. I thought maybe it was Cinco de Mayo or something, and they were giving out samples. It was just wonderful. And I was happy. I was really happy. And ever since then, I have said, Jana, may you be happy. And I have made metta a part of my practice every day since then. And I offer metta to myself and to my loved ones and to any friend or friends who pop into my head, to people who are of no consequence, like the postman. Or the, you have no idea how many clerks in New Seasons I know and love and wish them a wonderful day every time I see them. And even to people who are giving me a hard time. Not too long ago, I got to go to a memorial service for a Dharma friend's mother. And I did not know the deceased, but I understood that she became a practicing Buddhist and that she practiced metta as well. And we recited together a few of the verses that she would quote. And I thought to myself, Jana, you got to broaden your metta practice because yours is just too narrow. And I have done that ever since. But that's just another way of understanding for me that the Dharma is everywhere. And if you're ready to hear it, it's there. The last book I'm going to reference is Cultivating the Empty Field. These are my notes from it, several pages. It's by Taigen Dan Leighton, and it's about Hongzhur and his poetry and essays. And I actually got to go to a workshop with the author at Upaya Zen Center. Excuse me. And that was quite a few years ago. And so when I heard this summer that Great Vow was doing a session on silent illumination, which is one of the things Hongzhur is famous for, I thought, this is great. And they were going to use that book as the text. They were going to teach from that. And I thought, I need a refresher. This is really great. And it was online. So I'm sitting here in this office on my little bench on the first day of all day sitting. And I started laughing out loud to myself. Because I heard for the first time, cultivating the empty field. I am sitting here cultivating the empty field. And it just blew my mind that it took me 5 years or more to figure that out. And not too long ago, that was in July, a couple of months ago, I was talking to Domio about my Zazen. And I said, you know, when I really focus on what's in my head, I can see that there's nothing there. But when I do that, it's really hard work. Isn't Zazen hard work, Domio? And she gave me this knowing smile. And she said, you know, the more you practice, I think it's going to get a lot easier. And that was when I realized that cultivating an empty field is not work. Cultivating a field is hard. Cultivating an empty field is non-work. Again, you know, the Dharma will appear when you're ready. There's a little story that goes around in 12-step meetings about a guy who's down and out, and he goes to his first meeting and he sits there and he listens to the whole thing and he leaves and he comes back the next day and he looks a little bit better and he sits there and he listens and he leaves, and then he goes to his next meeting and he's looking better, but he turns to the guy sitting next to him and he said, how long do I have to keep going to these meetings? And the answer is, until you love them. And I've only been sitting Zazen for 6 years now, but I know that I have sat long enough to love it. And Domio tells me that if I sit longer, it'll get easier. And I believe that. So I just want to leave you with a couple of things, all in the spirit of the Dharma is everywhere. And there are jewels in there for you, and you may not hear them now. But we read these crazy things together, and we do these crazy chants on Sunday morning. I can't encourage you enough to download the chant book and read along. Turn the volume down on your computer. I know my voice is old and cracky, and I have hay fever, and it drives me crazy. But chant along, and you will someday, maybe next Sunday, maybe next Tuesday, maybe in a week, maybe in a year, hear something that you can apply in your life. From the Genjo Koan, these things, as you can tell, I'm very emotional, but these things really grab me. Since the wind's nature is ever present, the wind of the Buddha's family enables us to realize the gold of the great earth. and transform the water of the living river into cream. Your life can be like sweet cream, and you can find gold. From the Kyochu Kaimon, which we read every Tuesday night up until we do Jukai. From these precepts come forth such a wind and fire that all are driven to enlightenment when the flames are fanned by the Buddha's influence. We can all be enlightened. It's a promise. Another promise in Silent Illumination, but he puts the promise first and then he tells you what you have to do. The field of boundless emptiness is what exists from the very beginning. You must purify, cure, grind down, and brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. Then you can reside in the clear circle of brightness. And I will end with this one, again from Vukan Zazengi. Please, honored followers of Zen, revere the one who has gone beyond learning and is free from effort. Accord with the enlightenment of all the Buddhas. Succeed to the samadhi of all the ancestors. Continue to live in such a way, and you will be such a person. The treasure store will open up itself, and you may enjoy it freely. Now I can relax.
Jinro, this is Bruce. I just want to say thank you for your talk, and I admire your courage, and it has inspired me a great deal. I've been pretty down last few months, haven't been real good at my practice, but I think this is enough to light a fire under myself and get back to it. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jinryu, I loved your talk. Thank you. I wasn't bored. I'm inspired all through the day, so rest assured. It was a pleasure, great pleasure.
I'm reposting the books because someone said, you really kind of have to do the chat when everybody is here. I posted them during the breakouts.
Jinryu, I am so impressed by how hard you have worked, how focused you've been, and inspired by it, because I have been nothing but unfocused. So I will take many, many gems from you, from your talk. Really appreciate it. Thanks for sharing.
This is Pat. My question is, I would like to listen to this again. I know I would. And you talked about it being very private. And so I'm concerned about whether or not we can have access to it.
Yes, it's being recorded. And all I mean is that, generally speaking, the other community I'm in takes anonymity very seriously. And so all I'm saying is let it stay within the confines of this talk. And I think Marcia was going to say something.
Can you hear me? I think I unmuted myself. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to say thank you. And I'm really in awe of your ability to share yourself. And it makes it so much more powerful and inspiring that you're able to, you know, that you share your own journey rather than sometimes when we're reading books, it feels more intellectual. And this was really meaningful to me. And I just wanted to say thank you and that also I was riveted every minute of the talk. It was really inspiring. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcia. And I'm a little bit shocked, but thank you. I believe you.
Well, good.
Jinreal. Jinreal, this is Ruth Ann. You are a lady of liberty at this time. Your relentless graciousness, we need that at this moment more than ever. Humbleness is just rich. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Jinru, could I just say I ditto what everybody else said, and I thank you for your vulnerability. It made quite a big impression, and you did a wonderful job.
Thank you, John. I don't want to stop all the accolades. They're really great. But I did have a question. And I just encourage people to think about their own way-seeking mind. You know, maybe you don't feel like you have one, and that's okay. Maybe it'll emerge over time. But if you feel as though you do, I'd love to hear people's thoughts about where it comes from. My personal view is that I was born with mine. Or maybe it just came out of that miasma that was my childhood. And think about what are the characteristics of someone with a way-seeking mind. Ruth Ann, did you want to say something?
Oh, no, thank you. I forgot to mute myself again after speaking, but your question is appropriate, I think, again, especially this time.
I would say curiosity is a huge part of a way-seeking mind, for me anyway. Wondering what the hell this is all about and how it affects me and what I can do about it. So I think that's a big part.
I would think that stubbornness and ironically a kind of dissatisfaction feels like it's central to me, that you know, surrounded by people who are just like, meh, well, this is the way it is. And I was like, no, it's got to, there's got to be a better way. There's got to be. And like stubbornly sticking with that, even when other people don't agree. And then finding, so amazing to find Sangha, to find other people who thought that way. No, that was my big, you know, and I was at the, you know, lucky age of 26 when I encountered Sangha and found like, wow, there's other people who say there's got to be a better way, and I want to examine this life.
Oh,
say I really agree with the how you said that for you, you feel like you were born with a way-seeking mind. And I kind of feel like it's always sort of been there for me too, like always in the back, like kind of functioning. And what Domia just said, like, you know, there's got to be a better way. This can't be it. I don't really agree with kind of what's being fed to me, like this story that's going on. But I think stubbornness can play multiple ways. And one of the things that's funny I feel about for my path or my journey is for a very long time, and I know I shared this with the group I was with for the student term program, our first retreat, is I always thought I would never turn to Buddhism. I always was like, that's the last thing on earth that I ever want to do. And like, part of it was, I grew up in the 90s and all the celebrities are into Buddhism. And I was like, oh, that's just like, you know, that's a passing fad. And so it's like, I stubbornly railed against it for decades, you know, decades and decades and decades. And yet, you know, when you think of finding your way, you know, there's 360 degrees, you know, that you can turn around and look for a way. And I feel like I eliminated the other 359 degrees and one was left. And that was the one I took. And it was the one I never thought I would. And now I'm here. So I think stubbornness, yeah, it works out in a variety of ways. I don't know.
Could I add a PS? I think I'm going to try that meta thing on myself. I might need it. It seemed to make sense when you did it. You know, what you said to yourself, maybe I should try that on me. So thanks.
Thank you for your talk. I, like you, I grew up in a very patriarchal, right-wing evangelical Protestant religious tradition and, you know, was forced to go 3 times a week until I was 18 and didn't have to anymore. So I would say for me, part of the way they train men and boys in order to achieve this sort of male dominance on a day-by-day basis is to be emotionally invulnerable, to labor under this illusion that you're autonomous and you don't need anybody, but that everybody needs you, right? So I guess for me, I answer your question when the first words that came to mind to answer your question were like vulnerability and softness. And Zen was my first, what I came to Buddhism into. And I just felt like Shikan Taza was a radical vulnerability. And a friend of mine a long time ago, a yoga teacher friend, had taught me metta meditation. And I'd always kind of practiced those side by side. And more recently, with all the isolation, picked up the other Brahmaviharas and started practicing those as well. So there's a really profound softness of heart that those practices develop. So I'll find a way to maybe send you my email, maybe if you want to practice together sometime. But I just wanted to thank you for mentioning your side-by-side practice of those two things.
I'll put my email in a chat to you.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Jinryu, and I encourage anyone who has taken the precepts and been around for a few years to just start reflecting on and what it is that you might have to share about your own spiritual journey. Because as people are observing, I mean, this is, I had the wonderful fortune of growing up in a sangha that had many teachers by the time that I got there. Not only did I have Kyogen and Gyokuko were a married couple, but then there were already senior students who were taking on teaching roles by the time I got there. So there was always these different voices and these different approaches to things that, you know, one teacher might tell you something and it just doesn't register, and then somebody else says it in it and it does. So thank you all for being here. I will close with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. Bye.
Thanks, everybody.
Congratulations on staying focused with the cat in your lap, Jinryu.
Well, now after she's got her little toy down here. All she wanted was to play.
Hearing parts of it, yeah, her head, or and when she went like this on you. Oh, pretty cute.